The skinny bill is out, but so is the fat mouth. And John Kelly is in to restore order. Good luck with that, from the political junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. President Trump may not lead the league in good approval ratings, but is impeachment the answer? Congressman Brad Sherman thinks so.
The very thought of impeachment is going to get the people around the president to push him to behave in a more careful manner and get him to control his impulses. The president's fate is in his own hands.
Still, with accusations flying and a special counsel searching for the truth, is it too soon to compare the Russia investigation to Watergate?
The first big saying was follow the money. And we're seeing the same thing right now with Trump. He's drawn a red line saying don't look at the money or you'll be in trouble. But in both cases, the real issue was the obstruction of that investigation.
And we remember the Senate record of South Carolina's Fritz Hollings, who started out as a segregationist, but later became a fighter for the poor and the disadvantaged.
He was interacting with people on all sides of every issue, and he just didn't write a book about those hunger tours and then step away from the issue. He wrote a book about it, and then he went to work in Congress to make sure we could do something about it.
It's all coming up on The Political Junkie, which starts right now.
You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike.
For president.
Add Ike to you, add Ike to me, I don't care how you quote it.
Come on and vote for Kennedy, vote for Kennedy, and we'll come out on top.
Vote for Richard Nixon and Henry Cabot Lodge, cause they're the ones to lead the USA.
Thanks for joining us, and welcome to episode 190 of The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. It seems like every show begins with, can you believe the week we just had? But this time, I really mean it. Was it only last Friday morning that the McConnell skinny health bill went down to defeat? Seems like ages ago. The dramatic moment? 1:30 in the morning. Listen closely as Senator John McCain walks in the chamber and gives a thumbs down and says no, essentially defeating the bill. You can't see it, but Mitch McConnell is standing there, looking sullen with his arms crossed. When McCain gave his thumbs down, Democrats on the floor started clapping. Now listen closely for McCain's no.
No.
One of the most dramatic moments in recent Senate history. A devastating defeat for the Republicans and President Trump. After the 49-51 vote, McConnell faced reality.
This is, clearly a disappointing moment. From skyrocketing costs to plummeting choices and collapsing markets, our constituents have suffered through an awful lot under Obamacare. We thought they deserved better. It's why I and many of my colleagues did as we promised and voted to repeal this failed law. We told our constituents we would vote that way, and when the moment came, most of us did.
Voting against the bill, along with McCain, were two other Republicans who were no votes from the beginning, Susan Collins of Maine and Lisa Murkowski of Alaska. But until McCain showed up with his thumb down, no one knew which way it was going to go. I can't think of another senator who went from being reviled one moment to being celebrated the next, or vice versa, all in the course of 3 days. Love him or hate him, this may be McCain's final Senate legacy. But healthcare was hardly the only disaster for the White House this week. Let's start with that foul-mouthed, obscenity-laced interview White House Communications Director Anthony Scaramucci gave to The New Yorker. I know he was probably summoning his inner Trump, the smart-alecky, wise-guy New Yorker, but the language in which the main target was White House Chief of Staff Reince Priebus went way beyond the pale. Knowing the situation was spinning out of control, President Trump got rid of Priebus and brought in Homeland Security Secretary John Kelly as his new chief of staff.
We all know him, we respect him, admire what he's done. I have no doubt that he will be an absolutely superb chief of staff.
And then he went into specifics.
We have a lot of tremendous things going. We have some interesting situations that we'll handle, North Korea, Middle East, lots of problems that we inherited from previous administrations, but we'll take care of them. We'll take care of them very well. But overall, I think we're doing incredibly well. The economy is doing incredibly well, and many other things. So we're starting from a really good base. I predict that General Kelly will go down in terms of the position of chief of staff, one of the great ever, and we're going to have a good time, but much more importantly, we're going to work hard, and we're going to make America great again. It's all about making America great again.
And lest we forget, General Kelly will go down as one of the great ever. For his part, Kelly arrives with a solid reputation for restoring order. And his first order of business, the dismissal of the White House communications director. After just 10 days, Scaramucci was out. One person who wants to be in the White House, that is John Delaney. He's a three-term Democratic congressman from Maryland, and he's announced that he's running for president.
A successful businessman, lucky enough to be elected to Congress, and able to serve incredible constituents from an amazingly diverse and beautiful state, giving me the chance to fight for the causes I believe in. And this I know beyond everything. This is not a nation where success is a birthright. It's earned. It's earned through hard work, and it's made possible by a commitment to a shared destiny, and then a set of policies that can and should make it possible.
Of course, the last sitting member of the House to be elected president was James Garfield back in 1880. But that doesn't keep us from this week's trivia question. Of all the House members who have run for president, which one received the most votes in the primaries? You need to name the member of Congress and the year he or she ran. Send your answer to trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll select a winner at random from the bunch. The winner will get a fabulous vintage Political Junkie button. Again, that's trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. I concede you may have had some trouble answering last week's trivia question, but I'll explain why later in the show, so stay tuned.
Master of the house!
Master in the home!
Captain the philosopher!
His unfavorable polling numbers are growing, and his administration probably just went through its worst week since the inauguration. And a USA Today poll released last week showed 42% of Americans want to see President Trump removed from office. But as of now, there's only one congressman who's pushing for his impeachment, and that's Brad Sherman, a Democrat from the San Fernando Valley of California, who's in his 11th term. When asked about impeachment, Democratic leaders, notably Nancy Pelosi, are quick to say it's premature. But in a recent news conference, she sounded a bit more open to it.
We need to follow the facts, and what did the rest of the family know, and when did they know it? So this is, you know, I've always been reluctant because I think impeachment is something that really has an impact on the country. So when the facts are clear, the law is certainly clear, when the facts are clear, then this Congress will make a decision in that regard. But I hope that the Republicans will not stand in the way of the American people getting the facts. When the president has clearly stated he can do whatever he wants, he's not accountable.
If impeachment seems premature to some of the Democratic leadership, it's certainly not premature to Sherman. He was on a panel I moderated at the Politicon convention in Pasadena this weekend, a panel where the focus was Watergate and impeachment. Afterwards, I sat down with the congressman and talked about what he was trying to accomplish.
I submitted House Res 438, which impeaches the president for obstruction of justice.
Why do you feel the president should be impeached?
Well, we have clear evidence of obstruction of justice. I took an oath to protect the Constitution, which provides for the impeachment of a president when he's committed high crimes and misdemeanors, and obstruction of justice is a felony. And there are three instances. The first is in February, he threatened the FBI director to get him to abandon the investigation against Michael Flynn. And when you use threats to stop a criminal investigation, even if you just try, whether you're successful or not, that is obstruction of justice. People have been sent to jail for that. Second, he fired Comey and said that his reason for do so was to curtail the investigation into Russian collusion. Again, you don't need to be successful in your obstruction of justice. If you try to obstruct justice, that is a felony. And third, at least many have interpreted his comments made to Mueller, where he in effect tells Mueller not to pursue an investigation of Trump's personal finances, as a third instance of using threats to curtail a federal criminal investigation. So when the Constitution calls for impeachment for high crimes and misdemeanors, and a president commits obstruction of justice two or three times, it's time to submit articles of impeachment.
Before we even talk about how the Republicans would respond to something like that, what are you hearing from your Democratic colleagues?
Well, there's a range from my Democratic colleagues, not so much on the legal analysis. They all agree with my legal analysis, but just what's the right legislative strategy. And I think we've agreed that the appropriate thing for the Democratic Party now is to be talking about impeachment at roughly the 10 decibel level. If you were to have all the leaders of the Democratic Party gather together and submit articles of impeachment, that would be at too high a decibel level. But you can't resist talking about impeachment. If I hadn't submitted articles of impeachment, you'd still be talking about impeaching Donald Trump. And my hope is, and we've seen just a tiny bit of this actually coming true, that the very thought of impeachment is going to get the people around the president to push him and warn him and get him to control his impulses, perhaps to avoid some reckless decisions. And the president's fate is in his own hands. My articles are just one illustration of why he needs to control his impulses. And when Lindsey Graham warns the president not to fire Jeff Sessions and says, if you do, all hell will break loose, there's only one hell that the senator's referring to, and that is impeachment. So talk of impeachment and making it tangible with articles of impeachment could be used to perhaps get this president to behave in a more careful manner. His fate is in his own hands. If he acts in a more responsible way, I'll still disagree with him on most policies, and Democrats will still be angry at his policies, but he will survive his first term. If, on the other hand, he continues to be a guy that blurts out sensitive intelligence to a Russian foreign minister just on impulse, there'll be Republicans supporting my articles next year.
Do you realistically see that any kind of political threat aimed at the president could change his behavior?
Well, the fact is Donald Trump controls impulses every day, as everyone else does. You listen to that Access Hollywood tapes and he talks about grabbing this and grabbing that, but think of all the things he didn't grab. How many days does he walk? How many women does he walk by that he doesn't grab? And that's because all of us in society control our impulses when we have to. And he was bragging that as a celebrity, there were times when he didn't have to, but even he did not grab everything that was there to be grabbed at every moment.
And he was elected.
He was elected, and it showed that the American people have a high tolerance for some of the things that Trump apparently has done. But that doesn't mean that they have a high tolerance, not just for the violation of the criminal code. That by itself is sufficient, I thought necessary under my oath of office. But what would get Donald Trump impeached is a feeling in the country that we're not safe because the nuclear codes are in the hands of a man with insufficient impulse control. Not that he could never control his impulses, but his level of impulse control is lower than it needs to be.
The House Judiciary Committee voted to impeach President Nixon 2 years after the break-in. We are now talking about 6 months in his presidency. Do you envision the full House Judiciary Committee taking up your articles at some point?
Well, let's look at the Watergate situation. A year after the burglars were caught, articles of impeachment were introduced. A year after that, the Judiciary Committee voted in favor of those of articles of impeachment, and thank God Nixon resigned at that point, because he could have dragged it on even longer. A year after the cyber burglary of the DNC, the same entity is being hit. Articles of impeachment were introduced by myself, and it may be another year before there's a vote in the Judiciary Committee. And as I said, what happens is dependent upon how Trump governs in the future.
One big difference between Watergate, of course, is that it was a Democratic Congress in 1974, a Democratic-controlled House Judiciary Committee. At least as of now, Republicans control the House and Senate. Do you see that an impediment?
That is an impediment. Keep in mind, even after we listened to the tapes, even after we heard the smoking gun of Richard Nixon, only one-third of the Republicans on the House Judiciary Committee voted for articles of impeachment. Of course, the whole House never voted because Nixon resigned. And I would think that it's going to take a bigger wave of public consternation than we faced in 1974 to actually move articles of impeachment. But keep in mind, Nixon was competent, careful, and was not a Russian stooge. Trump, maybe different.
That was part of my conversation last weekend with Brad Sherman, a Democratic congressman representing the 30th District of California. He's introduced a resolution calling for the impeachment of President Trump. As of this broadcast, he has a total of one, count them, one co-sponsor. It remains to be seen if Congressman Sherman's effort to impeach President Trump goes anywhere, especially with the Republican Congress, though more and more GOP members are expressing their disappointment or frustration or astonishment at some of the president's actions. Still, the word impeachment, which in reality may be just a pipe dream for those who dislike Trump, is being said aloud more than ever. And with the firing of FBI Director James Comey, the possible effort to force out Attorney General Jeff Sessions, and the often less than honest responses regarding administration and Trump family members' meetings with Russians, comparisons to Richard Nixon and Watergate are sprouting up as well. Jill Wine Banks knows all about Watergate. She was an assistant special prosecutor during the Watergate scandal, working with Archibald Cox, the special prosecutor who was fired on President Nixon's orders during the famous Saturday Night Massacre in October of 1973. She joins us now to reflect on comparisons, real or imagined. Jill, welcome to the Political Junkie.
Thank you, Ken. It's a pleasure to be with you.
So do you see similarities between Watergate and what Trump faces with the Russian investigation?
I see a lot of similarities. It's important to also note some of the differences, but I think the similarities can really instruct us as to what the dangers to American democracy are, so it's important to look at them. Obviously, they both started with a break-in. In Watergate, it was a physical break-in. In modern times, the Trump break-in was through the Russian government, and it was electronic. We don't know at the beginning of either investigation whether the president or anyone from his staff is involved. So in Watergate, it took a long time to investigate and develop those connections. We'll have to do the same in this situation. Maybe it will be worse in this case than it was in Watergate, because Watergate was Americans breaking into the Democratic headquarters. In the case of the Russian hacking, you have clear evidence of a foreign government, an adversary of ours, being responsible for threatening American electoral process. If it is true that anyone from the Trump administration or campaign or family was involved in colluding with the Russians on that, that is a very, very serious problem, much more so than the underlying crime. But similarly, in both cases, the real issue, at first at least, was the obstruction of that investigation.
You know, you mentioned about the fact that it was 2 years in the investigation of Watergate, and I think that's a point that many people forget, that Richard Nixon's resignation was more than 2 years after the break-in, and here we are talking only about 6 months of a Trump presidency. So some people may be Trump defenders, but others say wondering or worrying whether we're jumping the gun, or do you think there is a there?
Well, I think that having more evidence faster may speed up the investigation. And when we compare the two, Watergate, the break-in was in June. The resignation was, as you said, not until almost more than 2 years later. We were appointed only less than a year after the break-in. So our investigation actually did not start until May of 73. By the time of March of 74, which is not very long, we already had indicted and had pretty much enough evidence that you could have impeached the president. We, in fact, and people forget this, we chose not to indict the president, but to name him an unindicted co-conspirator and to turn over evidence to the House impeachment, the House Judiciary Committee, for impeachment purposes. They used that going forward to return articles of impeachment.
When you were working in the Justice Department, when were you first assigned to work on this Watergate break-in?
I was one of the early hires and went to work almost immediately upon his appointment, May of 73. So the burglary was June of 72, and I became an assistant special prosecutor right after the office was formed and was assigned to the cover-up case. So our main focus really always was on the conspiracy to cover up the interference with the investigation of that crime, with the attempt by the president to stop the FBI from looking at the money that was used for paying the burglars. He really, that was the first big step, and the big saying of Watergate was follow the money. And I think we're seeing the same thing right now with Trump. He's drawn a red line saying don't look at the money or you'll be in trouble. That's where we found the first real clues that the committee to reelect the president had paid for the burglars. It was their money that was used to pay for the break-in at the DNC.
How long had you been on the case when you said to yourself, holy cow, or whatever you would say, we may be talking about the end of a presidency here?
Oh, that's a hard question. I did not start out when I was first appointed believing that the president was guilty. But shortly after, we had John Dean's cooperation, and he was a very persuasive, thorough witness who gave us dates, times, places, quotes, and details. When he testified before the Irvin Committee, he did not know there were tapes. He testified from memory, and it turns out that he's an incredibly good person to testify. He had almost photographic memory. However, at that point when he was testifying, the president would have had the benefit of the doubt. If it was his word, John Dean's, against the president's, I don't know that we would have gotten convictions, even though everything John Dean said was true. On July 17th, I think it was, that Alexander Butterfield testified, and we found out there were tapes. We immediately sprung into action to decide what tapes to ask for because we knew it was make or break for our case. Either they would confirm everything John Dean had said and we would have a rock-solid case, or it would show that he was inaccurate, and any inaccuracy could have destroyed the case and made the president able to argue, well, he was wrong on that. You could argue he's wrong on everything. It turned out he was right on everything, and that's when we knew for sure that everybody would be convicted.
You were part of the team, I think you were part of the team that cross-examined Rosemary Woods, Nixon's secretary.
I was.
That was regarding those missing 18 and a half minutes from one of the Watergate tapes. I remember that, and I'm gonna, you can't see me doing this on the radio, but she had this contortion-like explanation how she accidentally erased those 18 and a half minutes. Did anybody believe her at the time? Did anybody believe that she was really responsible for the gap? By the way, I just want to tell you, I just hurt my back doing that.
Oh, my God. I'm sorry about that. Yeah. Well, clearly she hurt her back doing it, too. And it really is too bad this is a radio show, because the cartoons from just her block alone are really wonderful. And if you have a website, I could try to photograph some of the cartoons which she signed for me.
Oh, wonderful.
Which really captured it. Plus, of course, the cover of every magazine and every newspaper was the portrayal of her doing this, which she failed to do in the courtroom in the teeny little witness box. She couldn't even do it. Her foot came off the pedal, and it stopped erasing. So I said, well, Your Honor, maybe we should continue this at the White House because she's claiming that she did it there. And no one objected, and we went off to the White House for a demonstration. They wouldn't let us bring a photographer, but they let the White House photographer take the pictures. And those are the pictures that we introduced in evidence the next day, and which were front page news, because it did show that it was impossible. We still don't know. It is the great mystery of Watergate. It is the only remaining mystery. It used to be we didn't know who Deep Throat was. We now know who that was, but we still don't know who actually erased the tape.
So that way, that famous picture of Rosemary Woods trying to replicate what she did accidentally, that is in response to your questioning?
It is, absolutely, yes.
Oh, I love it.
Yes.
I mentioned earlier in the program that support for Trump's impeachment is already up to 42%. As I recall, it took quite some time before Americans started talking about impeachment during the Nixon years.
Well, first of all, you have to understand Nixon was elected with an overwhelming landslide.
Right, 49 states, right.
He won 49 states, and that was the popular vote, not just the Electoral College.
Right. Is that how you do it back then?
Yeah, it is. It is. And back then, Democrats and Republicans actually talked to each other. And so when we started our investigation and the Senate started theirs, Ervin and Baker, who were the Democrat and Republican, who were the heads of that investigation, worked totally in cooperation. There was real bipartisanship, and it actually was the Republicans who went to the president and said, we've now seen the evidence, and if you don't resign, you will not only be impeached, you will be convicted by the Senate. And he resigned the next day. So it was definitely a bipartisan time. I don't know that we can ever go back to that. We now have a multiplication of media sources, and so the parties no longer have the same facts. And if you don't have the same facts, you can't have a reasoned discussion of what they mean. Back then, we talked about what the evidence meant, and we agreed that the evidence was real.
I heard a bark in the back. That wasn't Checkers, was it?
Yeah.
Every time we talk about Richard Nixon, I hear Checkers barking in the
right,
background.
Right, exactly.
But, you know, I mean, first of all, do we agree that impeachment is more about politics than it is about legal issues?
Yes, impeachment is a totally political process. And what's interesting, if we start comparing, is we have gotten to the point where our standard for the president's behavior is so low that we immediately jump to, well, is it criminal? That's not the standard we should be using. And there is now a memo saying that a president can be indicted for crimes. Even if he can, even if that memo is correct, I think that the right thing to do is impeachment, which is political. He was elected by the people, and the Constitution provides for a political solution, and I think that's probably the way we need to go, rather than saying everything has to be criminal.
But you know, I mean, first of all, you know, with a Republican Congress, it's kind of hard to envision impeachment hearings in 2017.
It is, except it was hard to envision the same thing in the Nixon era. And let's go back to another similarity, which is the Saturday Night Massacre. We had subpoenaed the tapes. The president stonewalled. He refused to turn them over. The courts ordered him to turn it over, and he still refused. He proposed a compromise that was absurd, called the Stennis Compromise, where he would give the tapes to a very elderly and nearly deaf senator who would listen to them and tell us what they said.
John Stennis of Mississippi.
Which is inadmissible evidence, so it would have been useless. And that's when the special prosecutor said, I need to go to the American people and explain why I need the tapes, why I have a right to the tapes, and why I can't accept this compromise. So on Saturday morning, October 20th, he had a press conference.
He, Archibald Cox,
the special prosecutor, he of great ethical stature, much like Robert Mueller now. And the result of that was the president wanted to fire him, but he couldn't. He had to get the attorney general to do it. The attorney general refused. So the Attorney General was let go.
Actually, he quit, right?
The Deputy Attorney General became the Attorney General. He wouldn't do it, so he got fired. So then it was the third in command, who is the Solicitor General, and he did it. The public reaction is what changed America. The public reaction was so strong that 3 days after that, Nixon did a complete U-turn. He said, I will give you the tapes. I will appoint a new special prosecutor. He appointed Leon Jaworski. He agreed to give us the tapes. And then on October 31st, on Halloween, he said, well, I'll give you the tapes, except two are missing. We had a tapes hearing in which we discovered that there was probably nothing askance, nothing torrid in his two missing tapes. And then the night before Thanksgiving, on Wednesday, November 26th, again, we're still in 1973, his lawyers come back to court in a drip, 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 much like what we're seeing again now, and said, whoops, there's a third tape that has a problem. It has an 18-and-a-half-minute gap. We had another tapes hearing. That's the one in which Rosemary Woods got thrown under the bus. The White House said, we can't find an innocent explanation, and we think that the only one who can explain it is Rosemary Woods. They pointed a finger at her, and that's when I cross-examined her for the second time. And that's when she did her demonstration that showed that she was not truthful.
The one that hurt my back.
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
Before wrapping up, I mean, we talk about there was a lot of discussion after the president fired James Comey. And then, of course, there's a lot of speculation about the future of Jeff Sessions. Could you see the sacking or the forced resignation of the Attorney General Jeff Sessions being akin to the Saturday Night Massacre?
You know, I'm a bad one to ask because every time I think we've hit the point at which the American people and the Congress are going to go, this is too outrageous, we can't go on like this, they ignore it and we keep going. And his strong supporters continue to support him despite what I see as evidence. They continue to believe that there was no collusion, and they believe his denials. But I read the emails. I mean, those are hardcore evidence. The emails say, we're getting together to give you Russian government documents to take down Hillary Clinton and help your father win re-election. That's a fact. You can't argue about that.
Sounds like collusion to me.
It sounds like collusion to me. And so I'd never know when we're going to get to the point. But I have to say, listening to a number of congressmen, Trey Gowdy,
the Republican from South Carolina,
said this is getting way out of control. I mean, many conservative senators are now saying he can't do that. If he does it, Lindsey Graham said, if he does it, there will be holy hell to pay. I hope that's okay to say on your radio. I'm just quoting a senator.
As long as you don't quote Anthony Scaramucci.
Oh, God, I wouldn't. And I almost was going to, in response to your thing about hurting your back with a stretch, but I resisted that temptation. Anyway, I don't know what it will take for the American people and for Congress to say we are embarrassed in the world community and we need to take action, and that our electoral system is endangered if we don't get to the bottom of what happened. If we can't get the president to unequivocally accept that the Russians hacked our system and could have caused voting irregularities, then we can't protect ourselves in 2018. And that's fast approaching. And I want to know that my vote counts as much as anybody else's. And so I want to make sure that the election process is not touched by the Russians again.
Jill Wine Banks is a former assistant special prosecutor during the Watergate scandal. She later served as general counsel of the U.S. Army, the COO of the American Bar Association, an executive at Motorola and Maytag. And even more impressive, she appeared on the Political Junkie program in 2017. That's a pretty impressive resume there. Speaking of Maytag, by the way, I remember the Maytag repairman was very lonely because he had nothing to do. Do you remember that commercial?
Right.
I suspect that Robert Mueller is not lonely and he has a lot on his plate, one would think.
I agree with you.
Jill, it was great having you on the program.
Thank you.
For all of those memories that I recall, there's all these bad goodies reminds me of you. The songs of the past bring back memories of you. Forever.
those oldies but goodies reminds me of you.
Anyone who listens to the Political Junkie week after week, known as the listener, knows that we have an affinity for political history. In recent weeks, we've talked about the Nixon impeachment vote, Chappaquiddick, Rod Blagojevich's Senate pick, John Kerry choosing John Edwards, FDR's court-packing scheme. There's a new book that takes this one step further. It's called On This Date, From the Pilgrims to Today, Discovering America One Day at a Time. A book that has an entry for every day of the year. It's by Carl Cannon, the Washington Bureau Chief of Real Clear Politics. And for the record, the book is not only about politics. For example, you'll be happy to know that Carl's entry for June 5th, 1993 is about Julie Crone, the first woman to win a Triple Crown horse race with her victory atop Colonial Affair in the Belmont Stakes. Still, there's enough campaign stuff in here to keep any political junkie satisfied. And Carl Cannon is kind enough to share his favorite anecdotes and stories from the book. Carl, it's great having you on the program.
Well, you're kind to have me, Ken, and it's always a pleasure to talk to you about politics or any other aspect of American civic life.
Well, thank you for that. You know, what I love about this book is that it's anything but the obvious, and it's a lot of forgotten facts. I mean, you could take an obvious event from a date, but instead you do the less obvious. What I'm saying is, like, for example, on November 13th, instead of the logical thing to do, which would be mentioning my birthday, you talk about the unveiling of the Vietnam Veterans Memorial in Washington.
Well, you know, there's a few obvious ones. I've got April 30th leaving Saigon, and around first week of July, Gettysburg, you know, July 4th, some of those. But what makes this book fun to write, and I hope it's fun to read for that reason, is some of the things that you mentioned. I mean, you know, August 5th, 1887, that's when Harry Longbow is sentenced to time in a local jail. We know him as the Sundance Kid, but that starts him off on this road that leads him into immortality. And these aren't just trivial dates. I'm trying to build a narrative, and if I did this right at the end of the book, people have a better understanding about the country and about some of the qualities that form, you know, what I term the American identity.
You mentioned the 4th of July, and I think that's a good example because, I mean, we know that both Thomas Jefferson and John Adams died on that day, that same day, in 1826, but I didn't know that Calvin Coolidge and Malia Obama were born on that date. Now, I know, I'm sure you know that George Steinbrenner was born on the 4th of July. You knew that, right?
Proving that God does have a sense of humor.
But did you know that former California Senator George Murphy was also born on that date?
The great song and dance
song
man.
And dance man.
Ronald Reagan's friend.
Exactly. But what I like about the book is that also on July 4th, and this I didn't know, it's also the date of a passionate speech about slavery in 1852 by Frederick Douglass. Now, I always felt that Douglass is someone who's doing an amazing job.
The speech he gave is what to the slave is the 4th of July. That's in 1856. In 1854, William Lloyd Garrison, the abolitionist from New England abolitionist, burned a copy of the Constitution at a rally in Massachusetts on 4th of July. He called it a covenant with the devil, a covenant with death, an agreement with hell is his exact phrase. But Frederick Douglass was more charitable than that and actually a deeper thinker. He gave the founders credit for the Constitution and said it was the best that they could do under the circumstances, but pointed to the Declaration, as Martin Luther King would do, you know, a century later, and said this is the document that we need to follow. And what have you done? He was not so kind to the sons and grandsons of the founders. He called them out. He said they weren't worthy to mention the names of these other people. Interesting speech.
Absolutely. That's what's so remarkable about the book. Now, this is, and some of it is fun, although when the way you lay it out, it sounds very serious, like the day when Barack Obama did not want to be in Denver debating Mitt Romney, October 3rd, 2012. What was that all about? Why didn't he want to be there?
It was his anniversary, and it was a big anniversary, and he just wanted to be with his wife, who was sitting in the audience. He wanted to hang out with her. And it was, you know, it was the debate that he blew. He said he called himself the luckiest man on earth. Lou Gehrig's great phrase, also uttered on July 4th. And then he turned to the moderator, was Jim Lehrer, and he said, he sort of talking past Jim to his wife and so to the First Lady. So I just want to wish, sweetie, you a happy anniversary and let you know that a year from now, we will not be celebrating in front of 40 million people.
I love
sweet
that.
Sweet moment, really.
It is a sweet moment. But some of it, you know, I was going through the book and I was going through so many different dates. Some of it is quite serious. September 5th, 1975, the assassination attempt on President Ford by a follower of Charles Manson, Squeaky Fromm, right?
Yeah, well, and then 17 days later, also in California, Sarah Jane Moore, you know, tries to shoot. And she could have actually killed him. Squeaky Fromm was this, you know, this nut and cult follower. But Sarah Jane Moore knew how to fire a gun. She'd bought it, obviously a troubled person, but she was involved in the city's left-wing politics and radicalized herself. And she'd gotten this, she was bought in the pistol that morning, and it was a, it had a malfunction. It fired, it wasn't true. It fired to the left, and she knew how to fire a gun. If she'd have tested, she probably would have killed Ford. What was striking about that one to me, and again, we can think about recent presidents and our current president. So Ford comes back to the White House, and he comes in the White House briefing room, and they start, you know, the court, press corps starts peppering him with questions. You know, I think my father was there that day. He said, you know, Mr. President, what are you thinking? What are you feeling? And Ford takes a big sigh, and he says, can I just have a minute, take a minute to look at all of you? And he says it with great affection. So here's a president who's been shot at twice, and it's reassuring to him to go in the briefing room and see the White House press corps. He takes solace from it.
I read that, and I love that. And you know, it's interesting. The Squeaky Fromm attempt was in Sacramento, and the Sarah Jane Moore was in San Francisco. This was so long ago that Jerry Brown was governor of California back then.
We didn't know to call him because I covered Brown then. We would have been calling him the once and future governor. But we didn't know.
Little did we know, right. Is there anything else in the book that you feel Americans have no clue about but should?
Well, I'm going to mention the first one because it's the opening of the book, and it's not a famous, it's almost a little, just a idiosyncratic thing. It's the first female taxi cab driver in New York. And the New York Times had a headline, Woman Taxi Driver Invades Broadway. Her name is Wilma Russi. And she shows up on the corner with her cab and this wild hat, early car, open, no front door, what we'd call a jalopy, these old cars. But what happens? So the first hurdle for her is the patrolman who's it's his corner. He walks up, are your papers in order? Well, they are. The second obstacle is the male cab drivers. What are they going to do? And they actually retreat to an opposite corner, like in a prize fight, and they caucus. And what they decide is, it's at 50th and Broadway, what they decide is, you know what, let's show some grace here. So they walk back across, and whatever they say, or they accept her. But then, you know, it's a service industry. What will the public think? And history knows the answer. This is January 1st, 1915. And a couple of young guys, young swains, hail her cab. They climb in. She says, where do you want to go, boys? And they said, no place in particular. Just drive down Broadway. We just want to ride in your cab. And, you know, she's not Rosa Parks, but in this way, you know, one little glass ceiling gets broken, you know, and this stuff happens in this country, right, every day for 200-300 years. And I'm trying to, you know, I'm trying to build a narrative. And that's one that I came across and I liked. And I think my publisher wondered why it was the first one. But the fact that we don't know about it and that it's a little thing is what attracted me to it.
Maybe one day New York City will have a female mayor.
Yeah. But right now it has a mayor who's a trailblazer in his way, you know, Bill de Blasio. His wife's African American. She had been living as a lesbian. He's the father figure to her kids. I mean, it's a pretty interesting American story.
What else stands out for you?
Profile in Courage of February 24th, 1868. And you and I, Ken, are old enough, although all our listeners aren't, to remember John F. Kennedy's book, Profiles in Courage.
I thought you were going to say we're old enough to remember 1868.
We're not quite that old. So in 1868, Andrew Johnson, who takes over for martyred Lincoln, he's the president. He fires Secretary of War Edwin Stanton. And Congress says you don't have the authority to fire your cabinet members. And that's what he's impeached over. And it's a big partisan fight. And Edmund G. Ross bucks his party leaderships and votes against conviction in the Senate and pays for it with his political career. And it's a forgotten story now, but it was forgotten when John F. Kennedy wrote about it. And the reason I include it is that it shows you people are forgotten in history, then remembered again, and then forgotten again. And this television program that grew out of John F. Kennedy's Pulitzer Prize-winning book, Profiles in Courage. It showed this. And I, as a little kid, I watched that riveting. I thought, I've never heard of Edmund G. Ross, but here was this guy who bucked the party. And Kennedy's whole book is about people who paid a political price for doing what they thought was right instead of following their party.
That's exactly the definition of Profiles in Courage, right?
I think so.
Well, Carl Cannon's book is called On This Date, From the Pilgrims to Today, Discovering America One Day at a Time. It's a fun read and a perfect book for any political junkie or news junkie. Carl, thanks for being on the program, and it's really, really an enjoyable book. Best wishes with it.
Thank you, Ken. That's very gracious. I appreciate it.
Don't know much about history. Don't know much biology. Don't know much about a science book. Don't know much about the French I took. But I do know that I love you. And I know that if you love me too, what a wonderful world this would be.
It's time to reveal the answer and winner of last week's trivia question, which was, who was the last attorney general who ran for public office after he or she was fired? Well, there's no winner because I screwed up. I was thinking the answer would be Elliot Richardson, the attorney general under Nixon during Watergate. But, duh, of course, he resigned. He wasn't fired. He resigned during the Saturday Night Massacre. He wasn't fired. Now, he did later run for the Senate in Massachusetts, but he lost the GOP primary. So then I was thinking, okay, maybe it's J. Howard McGrath, Truman's attorney general, who was fired in 1952 because he refused to cooperate in a corruption investigation. But no, Ken, he wasn't fired either. Truman asked for and got his resignation. 8 years later, he ran for the Senate from Rhode Island, but lost in the Democratic primary, blah, blah, blah. The fact is, no U.S. attorney general has ever been fired before. And thus, I withdraw last week's trivia question in shame. I apologize. But wait, aha! We do have a Scuttlebutton winner. That's that waste of time contest where you need to take a word or concept from each button I post and then come up with a familiar saying or slogan. Whew. The last contest led off with a Clinton-Gore election night button from 1992. Then our old standby from Minnesota, Jennings for Governor, Oofta. A libertarian live and let live button. A green button with the letters ING, ing, for Alaska Senator Ernest Greening. And finally, an in memoriam button for President McKinley. I'm still bummed out about that. So when you combine night of the living dead, you kind of get Night of the Living Dead, that independent low-budget zombie movie from 1968 that unexpectedly became a classic. George Romero, its filmmaker, died 2 weeks ago. And that's what made me think of this button puzzle. And the randomly selected winner is Francisco Prieto of Sacramento, California. Francisco wins the coveted political junkie button. We'll have a new Scuttle button puzzle up on our website this weekend. You can find that, as well as our political blogs, correct trivia questions, and the Political Junkie store, all at krpoliticaljunkie.com. It's time for This Week in Political History. 14 years ago this week, the senator from South Carolina made it official.
I want to confirm what you've all suspected, that I will not be offering for re-election this next year.
Ernest Fritz Hollings, a Democrat and a former governor, was first elected to the Senate in 1966. A seven-time winner, he announced in 2003 that he would not seek re-election the following year. But nothing Hollings has ever said has ever come without an accompanying barb, and he had them, both for President Bush and Governor Mark Sanford.
I can tell you this categorically. We've got the weakest president and the weakest governor in the history of my 50 years of public service. I say weak president in that the poor boy just campaigns all the time. He pays no attention to what's going on in the Congress. Karl Rove tells him to do this, do that, or whatever it is, but he's out campaigning. And I really don't think our friend Mark Sanford likes the job. And as a result, the state and the country, your state, my state, our country, is headed in the wrong direction.
When he left the Senate after 2004, Hollings had served 38 years and 55 days in that body, the eighth longest in Senate history. For 36 of those years, he was the state's junior senator to Republican Strom Thurmond. That was the longest tenure for junior senator in history. At 95, Hollings is getting up there in years. But to get a good picture of him, we have on the program Michael Copps, who for 12 years was Hollings' chief of staff. Mike is also a former commissioner of the Federal Communications Commission and is now a special advisor to the Media and Democracy Reform Initiative at Common Cause, the nonpartisan citizen advocacy organization. Mike, welcome to the Political Junkie.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here, and it's great to hear that voice of Ernest F. Hollings that you just played.
That voice is classic. You know, you think of the kind of characters that we have, we've had in the Senate, and, you know, we talk about Mavericks, and people talk about John McCain and Bernie Sanders, but I don't think they are the kind of characters the way Fritz Hollings was.
Fritz looked like a senator, and he acted like a senator, and he was a senator. He knew how to get things done. He came in a spirit of trying to get things done. It was a different era. It was not bereft of politics, but there was a little less of partisanship back in those days than there is now. And some of his best friends in the Senate who he hung out with were Republicans as well as Democrats.
Well, of course, when you mention when you think of when he first came into politics, I mean, he was elected lieutenant governor in 1954, governor in 1958, and he first ran for the Senate in 1962, a race he lost. I mean, the Republican Party in South Carolina didn't even exist back then. But also, when I think of you talk about a different era, back then, you know, in the 54, 58, and 62 campaigns, he ran as a segregationist. Is that fair to say?
No, I don't think that's fair to say. There was obviously a different mindset all over the country back at that period of time. But if you wanted to pick one fellow who was responsible for keeping the peace of the state and for successfully integrating Clemson University, it was Senator Fritz Hollings. He didn't resort to those George Wallace kind of histrionics and all. So I think he was ahead of his time. In his state on civil rights, no question about that.
Well, I would make the case, and we're not going to have a fight here, but I would make the case that during the campaigns he did run on segregation. But you're absolutely right. When he was elected governor in 1958, the state began to desegregate schools, and you mentioned Clemson. The first black student there was Harvey Gantt, who later went on to political fame in North Carolina.
That's correct.
When he ran for the Senate and was elected to the Senate in 66, and you say, yes, he did not run as a segregationist, but I remember him also being a strong opponent of Thurgood Marshall's nomination to the Supreme Court in 1967, just one of 11 senators who voted that way. So I know clearly there was a change in Fritz Hollings when he was not seen as an ally of civil rights and African Americans to the later years when he absolutely fought against hunger and fought on behalf of the poor. I guess my question is, do you remember a change in his thinking?
Yes, I think so. I think he would tell you that the vote against Marshall was one that he came to regret in the future years. And Fritz grew in the job. He was reading constantly, interacting with people on all sides of every issue, and his vision expanded.
I remember as far back as 1968, I remember he took tours of his state, and he was appalled by the vast amount of poverty he saw among blacks and whites. I'm going to play a little piece of tape what he said during one of those tours back in 68.
Well, it is shocking that in 1968 it's still this bad. We're the lowest per capita income state, second from the bottom. It's not a surprise at all that we do have poverty, but the housing conditions here are no less than shocking.
Well, I think it affected him as a human rights believer, and I think it had a tremendous impact on his conclusion that the state was being held back by this poverty. And as governor, as you probably know, he took lots of initiatives just to balance budgets, but to extend education, the father of educational television down in South Carolina in the late 50s and early 1960s. And when I joined him in 1970, he had just finished up the case against hunger. The book he wrote as a result of those hunger tours, and he just didn't write a book about it and then step away from the issue. He wrote a book about it, and then he went to work in Congress to make sure we could, as a nation, do something about it.
What do you think was his proudest moment?
Well, I think there are a lot of things in the public realm that you could cite as really bringing pride to him, but I think his proudest moment was in August of 1971, when he married Petsy Hollings, and she became part of one of the most dynamic political teams. She had such smarts, such political intelligence, so friendly, so open, and together they were just great, and they were deeply in love. And Petsy passed away a few years ago, Fritz taking care of her up to the end with Alzheimer's. That was his proudest moment.
I was going to say, I remember them being a real great team together.
Oh, my goodness gracious, yeah. If he'd been president, he not only been a great president, he'd have probably had the greatest first lady in all of history.
Do you have a favorite Fritz Hollings story?
Well, Fritz was fond of saying that the reason that he and Petsy got along so well was that they were both in love with the same man.
Classic. That's classic Hollings, isn't it?
That's a classic Hollings story. And, you know, there were others. Petsy told some reporter was dogging them when they were out in the West Coast one time, and the phone was ringing and ringing at 6 o'clock in the morning. So finally she picked it up and said hello, and the reporter, whoever it was, asked for Senator Hollings. The PC paused for a second, and then she leaned over to Fritz and said, "Honey, is your name Hollings?"
That says it all, doesn't it?
It really does.
Well, I mentioned earlier that he's 95 years old. He's the oldest living former senator. Do you get to speak to him much?
I should keep in touch with him every week or two. We talk. As a matter of fact, I hope to visit him sometime later this summer in South Carolina.
For nearly 12 years, Michael Copps was the chief of staff for South Carolina Democratic Senator Fritz Hollings. Since then, he served as a member of the Federal Communications Commission and is currently a special advisor for Common Cause's Media and Democracy Reform Initiative, where he fights for a free press. Mike, thanks so much for sharing your memories on this very fascinating senator.
I am happy to do it, and I'm delighted that you are doing this program, because this is a fellow who should go down in the annals of history as really the ideal public servant. I love the guy.
It was 14 years ago this week, on August 4th, 2003, when Ernest Fritz Hollings, by then the senior senator from South Carolina, announced he would not seek another term in 2004. You're listening to This Week in Political History on The Political Junkie.
I never dreamed you'd leave in summer. I thought you would go, then come back home. No, I never dreamed you'd leave in summer. And now my quiet nights are spent alone.
That's it for this week's show. Be sure to check out our website for much more political content and to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. It's all at krpoliticaljunkie.com. If you've got comments, questions, or complaints, certainly about the trivia question, send an email to ken@krpoliticaljunkie.com. You can also tweet us at Ken Rudin and at Ken Rudin Junkie, or follow the show on Facebook. And you can follow my button of the day on Instagram at The Political Junkie. Political Junkie is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. The show is produced by Devin Maverick Robbins, and Douglas Bell is our coordinating producer and engineer. I'm Ken Rudin. Thanks for listening. See you next week. You say-